Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to the Weekly Critic podcast. I'm Ben Sixsmith, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Nick Timothy. Nick Timothy is chair of the Future of Conservatism Project Onward, and is a sports columnist for The Critic, and has written some recent pieces for us about the Ashes throughout history and on into the present day. Obviously, the Ashes of 2023 are ongoing. England just had their first victory after 2 losses against Australia. Nick, what are your predictions, if I can put you on the spot, for the last 2 tests?
Oh, God, I don't know. To be honest, I started the summer quite pessimistic. I thought this would be the summer that Bazball was found out, partly because of the quality of the Australian attack. England were a bit different at Headingley. I thought they batted aggressively, but it wasn't quite the kind of kamikaze stuff that we saw in the first 2 tests. And the refreshed bowling attack just looked a lot better. I wonder if this is Anderson's last summer, and the pace of Wood made quite a big difference at Headingley.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Mark Wood obviously put in a great performance. Chris Wokes put in a fine performance with the ball and with the bat.
Yeah, well, Wokes is a great man because he played for the same club that I did when I was a kid. So I take some credit for that.
The automatic mark of quality.
Yeah, even though I've literally never met him.
It was interesting how the England's lower order seemed to bat more sensibly than the top order in the run chase. And I do wonder if that's a kind of sign towards a slightly more restrained English style going forwards through the series. I mean, it's obviously, it's easy for me as an idiot who watches from my sofa to comment on what England should be doing. But obviously it's unavoidable as someone who watches from the sofa to comment on what England should be doing. Do you think Bazball has run its course, at least through this series? Should England be switching up their tactics?
I think it depends on what we mean by Bazball, so, and why they're doing it. So it's kind of presented as this big sort of daring, brave, radical way of rethinking cricket. And I think in part it actually is a pragmatic approach, because it probably recognises that in the age of 2020 and you know, very short, rapid cricket, lots of the players who are available don't necessarily have the techniques to bat long innings of the, you know, the kind that certainly I grew up watching, sort of Mike Atherton 185 not out in a sort of rear guard defence in South Africa, that kind of innings. And I don't really mind the attitude that says, let's be assertive, let's be aggressive, let's try to create a culture where if a batsman makes a mistake, it doesn't feel like, the end of the world and the end of his career. But I think there have been times where it's just been too much, I think. And if you go through England's batting lineup, players like Pope and Brooke are actually really good players with classical techniques, and on occasion Stokes himself, who has a proper technique too, they've got out slogging in situations where they don't really need to bat like that. So I think it just goes far too far sometimes. But if they want to do a kind of dialed down Bazball, which is aggressive, assertive, but still playing properly, which is I think what they did at Headingley, then that's great.
The squad for the next test, it doesn't show many signs of changes. Moeen Ali is still there. Johnny Bairstow is still there. Folks, who could possibly be a replacement wicketkeeper, is not there. Do you think this shows kind of admirable consistency and loyalty, or hubristic inflexibility?
Well, I mean, it can be the former if you're winning and the latter if you're not, I suppose. I thought the treatment of Fakes was quite rough. I think he's the best wicketkeeper available. He's actually a pretty reliable batsman too. He's another one who bats properly. And so far in this series, you would say that Bairstow's selection has not worked. He hasn't scored the runs that I imagined they thought he might. And his keeping has been pretty awful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose it does depend, you know. If in the next test he scores 100, we're going to talk about their genius. And if he gets out for a duck and drops Steve Smith, we're going to talk about how ludicrous it is. But
perhaps, I mean, the first job is to keep properly. And Fuchs is capable of scoring test hundreds. He's done it before. So I think I would have, maybe I'm just too conservative for Bazball, but I think Fuchs would have been the wiser pick.
It's true. A drop at the wrong time can cancel out of the best of hundreds, yeah, sadly. So
for sure.
Wicket keeping quality is its own reward. But let's take a step back and give a kind of broader overview of the Ashes tradition. What are your earliest memories of the Ashes? For me, it's England being absolutely crushed in 2001, where I still remember Mark Butcher's triumphant innings in one single test that felt like this monumental accomplishment because we'd finally beaten Australia once. What are your earliest
memories? Well, that was quite a memorable one because it was, I think it was, God, I don't know how I remember these numbers. I think he scored 173 not out, and it was a really big run chase. It may have even been a record-breaking run chase. So that was quite a memorable game for those reasons as well. But as you say, I mean, through that period, watching the Ashes was, it was fairly uncompetitive and depressing as an Englishman. Undertaking, and it felt like we tended to be most competitive in the dead rubber games at the fifth game when the series was already won. But I think cricket's quite a funny sport because the way I behave at a football match and my attitude to sort of winning and appreciating the opposition, if Fulham were playing, I'm an Aston Villa supporter, if Fulham were playing a team with sort of Leo Messi at the peak of his powers, I'd be relieved if he hobbled off injured after a minute. I don't want to see him play against us. Whereas in cricket, you can really appreciate the kinds of players who are playing against you. And while I do want England to win, that Australia team through the 90s and early 2000s was extraordinary. And I was a leg spinner in my youth, so I loved watching Shane Warne. So it was miserable to watch us lose all the time, but the quality of some of the cricket was fantastic.
That's true. I mean, the batting as well, with Hayden, with Gilchrist, with the Wars. You had to respect it as much as you still hated the bastards and wanted them to fail as much as possible. You still had to respect them.
You did, and I think in a funny way, I think the selection of Bairstow, I think some people almost think of it as a kind of Gilchrist figure batting at seven, where he can be explosive and so on. But part of the point of Gilchrist's career batting at seven was he could be like that because he would quite often come to the crease with Australia sort of 300 for four, sort of 400 for five. And that's pretty different to if you're Johnny Bairstow coming in and England are 150 for five and facing an innings deficit.
That's true. He was something of an expert of rubbing salt into the open wounds of the English fans.
Yeah, I remember him just continually smashing sixes into the crowd at Edgbaston and thinking it was never going to end.
Well, what are some of your favourite Ashes memories, which I suspect will not include Gilchrist smashing sixes?
Well, I probably got two favourites. One is actually the 97 Ashes. The first test was at Edgbaston, and I went with my granddad, and it was the last sort of special moment I had with my granddad before he died. And that was quite a famous test. England beat Australia by 9 wickets. Like everyone was expecting Australia to hammer us, and well, they did in the end in the series. But we had them, I think, 6 down at lunch on the first morning, and bowled them out quite cheaply. And my brother was on Warwickshire's books as a youth player then, and he was a ball boy for the whole test, and so sort of met everybody. So that was all quite memorable for us. But I think the 2005 Ashes is the one that everybody of I'm older than you. I was going to say our age. Everybody of who's lived through the 2000s and loves cricket will think of the 2005 Ashes, and that really did have everything. Sort of drama, close finishes, high quality cricket, and obviously the fact that England took the Ashes from Australia for the first time in years.
No, me too. I mean, I remember when England won the Rugby World Cup in 2003. I was like, right, that's it for me with rugby. Like, I'm going out on a high note. And it was tempting to do the same with cricket in 2005 because it really felt like the sport just couldn't get better than that.
Yeah, and the celebration afterwards where they did the open deck bus and then went to Downing Street and were greeted by Blair and they were all absolutely hammered. I just remember the sort of the red circles around Andrew Flintoff's eyes, which I think some people were quite po-faced about, but they'd just done something extraordinary and they should have celebrated. My one of the funny things about 2005 for me was I'd spent years kind of moaning that this is our national summer sport and cricket doesn't get the attention that it deserves and football eats everything now. And then in 2005, and it was the last great series that was on free-to-air TV. And the whole country really got into it. And I found it really frustrating. It was all these people who didn't really follow cricket suddenly had opinions about Ian Bell. Were very dismissive about him, and I just remember thinking, well, you don't understand. He's a fantastic prospect. His technique is good, and then I maybe pined for it to be more of a minority pursuit again.
Well, at least history
It's
proved you
obviously the
right.
sport.
History proved you right about Ian Bell. So I'm sure they're eating their words fairly soon after that.
If they remember.
If they remember, that's true. If they remember. Many is the player that I've written off as hopeless and useless and
Oh,
should never
me too.
be picked again. And then I was later lauding them as a hero who I believed in all along.
I
Captain
remember there
Fraser-ish,
was an
that is.
Ashes tour of Australia in the 2010s. I can't remember which year it was, where at the start of the tour, I remember complaining about Alastair Cook's form and saying he was a walking wicket. And that was the series. That was actually, I think it was, that was the series where they basically couldn't get him out. And he and Jonathan Trott just scored 100 after 100. So
Britain has
probably.
changed a lot since 2005, and cricket has changed a lot since 2005. I mean, obviously, one day cricket was firmly established by then, but now we have 2020, we have the 100, we have the IPL, and it's often debated. But do you think Test cricket is going to retain its specialness going forward? I mean, every time there's a wonderful moment, like Ben Stokes hitting a magnificent run chase, people are like, "Oh, this is Test cricket. This is why Test cricket will survive." But I wonder if that kind of inherent quality is enough to sustain it in the face of the structural threats that it faces. Do you think Test cricket has a glowing future, or is it going to dwindle in relevance?
Well, I think cricket's an unusual sport in that so many people connect to the game, including lots of fans, but certainly commentators and administrators are always paranoid about its future. I always think the English Cricket Board's a bit like the Foreign Office. They fundamentally don't believe in their product, and they should. It's great. Lots of people love it. Don't worry about it. That's not to say that cricket doesn't need to sort of, evolve and change. And actually, it's very good at doing that. It's embraced technology far more successfully than other sports. It's changed its format in lots of ways, which has brought lots of new people into the game, which I think is a good thing. I like 2020 cricket. And actually, you can see how one day cricket and T20 cricket have changed Test cricket as well and made the players much more sort of adaptable. If you think about, did I ever see anybody play a reverse sweep when in the early years that I was watching cricket? I'm not sure I really did. Now it's absolutely standard. I mean, if you're facing this many, you see dozens of reverse sweeps in a day. So I think it's part of cricket changing. I suppose there's a question about whether Test cricket remains as popular outside. In particular, England and Australia, because while cricket is obviously enormous and crazy in India, and elsewhere, but India in particular, the fans do flock to the T20 and to the One Day Internationals. But if you talk to players, and I've been lucky enough to meet and know several past and present players, they all say, well, Test cricket is the pinnacle and it's the thing that I want to carry on playing.
Yeah, I think you make a good point about how sometimes people don't believe in the value of what they should be defending enough. It reminds me of endless debates about whether the novel is dead Which always makes me wonder how many of the participants have read any recent novels, or, you know, have gone looking for good novels to talk up, or whether it's almost a convenient excuse for holding the funeral.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm, well, I don't know what the numbers are, but I imagine there's probably more novels published than ever. I mean, it seems that way.
I'm sure you're right. I'm sure you're right. And speaking of cricket evolving and changing, but not necessarily for the better, recently we saw the publication of the Equity in Cricket report, which accused British cricket of racism and sexism and elitism and basically everything else that could end with ism. What did you think of this report?
I hated it. Not because I deny that there may be some problems and challenges in cricket, because, you know, cricket only really reflects the society it is played in. And I don't doubt that actually, you know, there will be some sexism, racism in the game. It all really came about from the allegations made by Rafiq from Yorkshire. And I do wonder whether there are some particular problems to do with Yorkshire. I mean, I think I'm right in saying that Sachin Tendulkar was the first non-white player to play for Yorkshire, and that was only in 1992. Which is a bit unusual and a bit strange. I can remember that happening and thinking, what? How can he be the first non-white player to play for Yorkshire? So I sort of preface it with the recognition that actually, you know, not everything's perfect. But in a way, I think this mirrors what has happened to wider debates about race and prejudice, where not that long ago, it felt like actually people across the sort of spectrum of political or ideological thought had reached a point where actually the conversations about race and disparities and discrimination and so on, it had reached a point where it was almost post-political and people were talking about problem solving and actually just being practical and how do we do these things. And what's happened with sort of critical race theory and some of the American culture wars that have found their way over here is that everything's now really polarized, and it's not enough to say, oh yeah, there's obviously a particular problem over here, so let's try to work out how to fix it. That has to be understood in the context of people claiming these systemic theories, which frankly I just don't really believe. These theories that are based on, if you go far back enough, I think they borrow ideas from French postmodernists and sort of theories of power structures in society. And basically, what they try to say is that there are kind of invisible forces in society that hold some people down on the basis of their identity and keep lots of people up on the basis of their identity, and that society works, you know, just in the interests of, you know, me, a white man, or you, a white man, and holds down others to our benefit. I don't accept that, and I think and unfortunately that was the logic with which this report was written, and it was always going to be that way because you know, the question asked and the panel chosen I think meant that that's what the conclusions were going to be. So the question was about equity in cricket. Now, equity is a loaded political term, which suggests a belief in equality of outcome and a disregard for equality of opportunity and treatment. So I'm not surprised that it was written in the way that it was, but I'm very upset by it, to be honest.
Yeah, there's this kind of assumption in elite liberal society that any kind of difference between groups of people must be explained by malign forces. So, for example, yeah. Niall Gooch made a good point in his piece on the report that it speaks about the declining proportion of British black cricket players as if it must be the result of, you know, discrimination and prejudice. Mm. And it ignores the declining proportion of Caribbean, well, people of Caribbean heritage in Britain, and the rise in the proportion of black British people from Africa, where, you know, they don't have a tradition of playing cricket, so it's kind of predictable they wouldn't immediately pick up the sport because it just, yeah, it doesn't come naturally. But they can't see a difference and say, you know, there must be some kind of interesting accidental factor involved here. It has to be, this is just a symptom of structural racism or structural prejudice.
Yeah, and I mean, if you were to use the word inclusivity in the actual sense of the word rather than the kind of loaded political way it's used now, you would say cricket has quite a lot to do. So it is, and I think cricket sort of struggles with this a bit more than some of the sports because it's a highly technical sport. And the later you start playing it, the harder it is to break through. And it's not a surprise, I think, that lots of elite cricketers that you see today are actually related to elite cricketers from a generation before, because they were exposed to the sport really early on and given that kind of technical knowledge and training. But you know, the equipment is expensive, the ability to play all year round incurs cost because you have to use indoor nets. State schools just don't play the game in the same way. So there's a job for the game to work with the government and education providers more generally to make sure that there's coaching available inside schools. And I think a really big factor is that it's not on free TV anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm lucky enough to be able to afford Sky TV, so I get to watch it all. But when I was a kid, we couldn't afford that, and my access to the game came from seeing it on TV and thinking it was entertaining and fun, and playing it at my secondary school. And you know, both of those two things apply to fewer people now than they did then. So the game has to do much more to be inclusive, and a lot of that work should be really proactive. And sure, if there are certain groups in society where we think actually there's some unmet potential in terms of participation or elite performance, or just as supporters, and people being entertained by the game, then sure, like start your programs. Do go and do your outreach work in the inner cities. Make sure that applies as much to the white working class as it does to, you mentioned people of Caribbean heritage or Asian heritage. I'm from Birmingham originally. Warwickshire's my team, and I think that they've made a real effort in recent years. They rebranded the 2020 team as the Birmingham Bears because I think the research they did suggested that a lot of Asians who live in Birmingham didn't feel the same connection to Warwickshire. They knew Edgbaston, the stadium. They're proud Brummies, but they didn't sort of feel the same sense of identity with Warwickshire. And that was one of the reasons why they changed the name for the T20 competition.
Hmm. Oh, I do think there's something of the traditional loss there. I mean,
it's upset a lot of people.
Still identify with Somerset or Lancashire or Kent today, but if Somerset rebranded themselves as, I don't know,
the Taunton Terriers,
I'd find it terribly, terribly sad.
Yeah, no, there's definitely loss in it, and I'm not saying it's necessarily the right thing. I just mean that they're trying. I find it very difficult to refer to Birmingham as, not least because in football, Birmingham are the sort of hated local rivals of my football team. But so I find myself just saying Warwickshire anyway.
Mm-hmm. One of the most ambitious recommendations of the report, which applied to their claims of sexism in the game, is the insistence that the pay of male players of cricket and female players of cricket be equalised within pretty much the next few years. I wrote a piece arguing that there is at least some extent to which the male and female game, men's cricket and women's cricket, will always be unequal because people do want to see the best in the world, and unavoidably the best in the world is going to be men's cricket. Now, obviously, that's not a perspective people have to agree with, but what do you think of the report's recommendations regarding equal pay?
Well, I think it's obviously a bit complicated, this, and people will have different views, and that's fine. I think cricket's made quite a lot of progress with the women's game and girls playing I say this as a dad and stepdad of daughters. So I, you know, I want to see girls playing the game as well as boys. And you do see it differently when you see little girls and sort of, and they, you know, they see that actually it's the men's game that's on the TV more than the women's game and so on. So, you know, why is the that disparity? So I'm sort of quite sensitive to that. But I think you have to be a bit realistic about the fact that the, you know, the men's game has been incredibly well developed for quite a long time. And that is what has driven a lot of the revenue for the game. You know, the women's game, I think, has made enormous progress in quite a short space of time, and they're doing a pretty good job of marketing it and getting crowds to the women's games. So actually, I think this stuff is actually likely to happen organically anyway, because the women's game will actually raise its own revenues. If in the medium term it remains the case that the men's game continues to raise greater revenues than the women's game, then, you know, there's just the straightforward choice for the sport. Do you say, well, actually, you know, to some extent, the salaries are going to be sort of hypothecated and sort of, you know, relate to the distinct men and women's games? Or do you say, well, actually, for social reasons, we're going to do something different and we'll make sure that they're split more equally? I mean, that's a choice that the, you know, the administrators of the game will end up making. But yeah, I think the point of the report is it was like, you know, it didn't recognize, you know, how far the game has come in quite a short space of time, and just sort of kind of berated the sport for you know, the fact that things aren't absolutely equal right now. It's not a surprise that they're not.
There can never be good news in reports like this. That's true.
Certainly not.
There can never be good news. And it's certainly true that women on many levels can be equal or even superior to men. I mean, I grew up playing youth cricket in Bath, where at a time when, is it Anya Shrubsole who went on to play for England?
Yeah.
Was coming up in youth cricket. And I don't think there was a man in Bath who was terribly excited about walking to the crease to face her.
Yeah, exactly. So, and actually, I was a groundbreaking cricketer in this respect in my youth, because I remember playing for my school and getting out to a girl. And I was mocked roundly by everyone, but she was a really good cricketer. It was no big deal.
One of my funniest memories is when a friend of mine went to a boxing class and he came back and I said, how was it? And he said, oh, it was really awkward. They put me with a girl. And I was saying, like, you know, oh yeah, it must be really embarrassing to have to hit a girl. And he was like, no, it's embarrassing because she kicked my ass.
I'm actually friends with somebody who was a female boxer, and she was utterly brilliant and terrifying.
It definitely can happen. One more very nerdy question that I'm really going to put you on the spot with. One of my favorite conversation topics with my dad when I was younger was to talk about our best ever cricket sides, our best ever cricket sides starting with the letter G, our best cricket sides from South Africa or whatever. Who would be in your best ever Ashes sides, including all English players and all Australian players?
What, so you're allowed a mix of English and Australian?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, this is really unpatriotic, but Shane Warne has to be the first on the list, doesn't he? I think. And then I think Andrew Flintoff just for 2005. Mm-hmm. The English have actually just produced amazing all-rounders in Ashes battles through my lifetime. I mean, you talk about Stokes, Headingley. But Headingley was also where Botham famously won the match single-handedly after England followed on in the early 80s. So maybe the middle order will be packed with English all-rounders.
But maybe not Moeen Ali, bless him.
No. well, he's a Brummie spinner, so you know I have some loyalty to him, and he now plays for Birmingham, as we've discussed. They're called in the 2020, but I mean, I think that just goes to show that actually, as soon as England lost Leach, it just shows a sort of a lack of depth in English spinning, which is something we'll always probably suffer from because of our climate. But he's a slightly funny call-up to me. I mean, I just think he's you know, the old rule is if you're an all-rounder, you need to be good enough to get into the team either as a batsman or a bowler. And, you know, I think if we were honest, you know, he's not the best in the country at either.
Yeah, I mean, apparently he's the 16th highest wicket taker for England ever. So I should put some respect on his name, but I can't help feeling, well, I can't feel optimistic when I see him come to the crease in either role.
Yeah. Well, he's been picked a lot, but his average and his economy rate for a test spinner are both higher than they should be.
Do you feel optimistic for the next test?
Well, I think I do actually. I probably feel more optimistic now than I have through the series because of the my dog is barking. I don't know if you can hear that. Sorry. I think I feel more optimistic now because of the difference Wood and Wokes, but in particular Wood, made to the team. Actually, because I think, funnily enough, the inclusion of Wokes has made a difference because, you know, the tail was very long in the first couple of tests, and Ollie Robinson must wish he'd never said that Australia have three number 11s, given what happened with the Australian tail batting well. But actually, England have batted as though they've had three number 11s at different points. Whereas with, you know, with Wokes back in the team, that gives a bit more depth. And, you know, Wood himself actually batted brilliantly at Headingley.
Absolutely. I'm feeling optimistic too. The dog is feeling optimistic too. That's why it's crying out in excitement.
He was shouting his roar of approval for the English cricket team.
Nick Timothy, thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you very much.